Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of Two-Headed Game Master. I'm Cosmo, the first head.
And I'm Dane, the and now you can too head.
Two-Headed Game Master is a podcast about writing, designing, running, and playing role-playing games, where we discuss our favorite hobby, share our thoughts with you, and play some games sometimes. Back to our regular programming after that banger of a interview 100 episode.
Now we gotta start from one again.
Yeah, it's just one, and nothing interesting happens again until like 200. But that's not even that interesting of a number. It's really like 500 before we can even make us think about anything again. So, back to basics, regular 2HGM episodes where we talk about the stuff. What are we talking about today?
Well, there are a lot of different RPGs out there, as faithful episode 100 listeners may know. We did a little showdown. Which was very fun.
That wasn't even all of them.
That was only like eight or whatever.
There's like at least five or six more.
So it can be hard to pick, right, the RPG for you and your group. We actually did a episode on choosing RPGs.
Yeah, how to choose the system.
So this is a different solution. It's like, oh, well, I couldn't really find one we liked. Well, we have a solution for you. Why not make your own?
Yeah.
Because we did, and so can you.
So can you. Yeah. So
that's what this episode is about, is us making Afterlife. We thought it would be a good continuation, I guess, of episode 100, because we talked for like 3 hours, basically about that.
We talked a lot, especially in the first like third of that episode, about how we got started doing stuff together in general, role-playing games, this podcast, the stuff we were creating. But it was a little bit messy, I think you could say. You know, we were having a lot of fun, but this is a this is more structured, more focused, more sort of regular episode about the idea that, yeah, you could just make your own. And we kind of recommend it, I guess. Like, it's cool. Maybe you should make your own.
Let's get into some sign cones. I almost said pine cones.
Pine cones.
And then it was sign cones. All right, some signposting here. We're going to talk about us making our own RPG, Afterlife, which is available for buy on DriveThruRPG. More about that later.
Yeah.
And then we will talk about the lessons, how making our own system made us better role players, both GM and player style.
Yeah. All this stuff we learned from it.
So, without further ado, the making of Afterlife!
Yeah.
That was a fun voice.
Yeah.
Right, so, if you haven't
like
listened
Jiminy
to...
Jiminy Cricket ripoff from Puss in Boots.
Episode 100 kind of gets through the story of, like, you know, how we kind of got started. So we don't need to rehash everything. But we are going to rehash a little bit, right? Talking about the making of Afterlife. So first, we did it and started doing it and continued to do it because it was just fun to spend time with each other and talk about crazy ideas.
It structured our hangout time a little bit, you know, sort of gave us a task. Well, we gave it to ourselves, but I was like, well, we're hanging out, having a good time, and also making progress on something that we were both excited about and passionate about. And, yeah, it was a thing that came naturally out of just enjoying this sort of content and activity. And we were like, game design, I guess. We should just make one, right?
Yeah,
at some point.
Because we were talking about all the things that we liked about this system or another, and like, oh, I saw video essay on this, or like, you know, Fallout New Vegas did it this way, and yeah, so if you're like us, you're probably kind of already doing that stuff and, like, you know, talking about it and adding things into whatever current system you're using or are getting ready to use.
Even if you gave it, like, none thought at the beginning and were just like, well, D&D, it's the first one there. You get the books at Target. Mm-hmm. You get the books at a Barnes & Noble. It's accessible because it's right in your face all the time, everywhere. So even if you gave not a single thought at the very beginning to what system you were going to try and you just went right into D&D, you probably already are, and you probably started earlier than you think, engaging with game design to a degree.
Right, and like this can be as simple as just like tweaking like character creation or like adding in homebrew content, whether it be monsters, maybe a homebrew feat for D&D, if we're talking D&D.
Yeah.
Right? Like, oh, well, here's my own feat because all these listed are suck. Yeah. So, boom. You've already dipped your toes into game design.
Right. And as a game master, you know, the encounters that you put together, unless you 100% gave your player group pre-written stuff, like published adventure modules or things that you'd gotten from other people online, you're putting that stuff together. That is some game design. Just the very act of game mastering itself, you're already interacting with it a little bit.
Yeah.
With the concept of designing and tweaking.
Right. Challenges or encounters, if you will. Right. You are designing those and you are applying rules, and like, sure, you might be using the book, like the Monster Manual, to design those encounters, to help you design those encounters. But probably you're doing a lot of game design that you don't really realize.
You are engaging with game design still. And that's kind of what we found. We didn't play D&D first. We played Torg first. And there was a lot of stuff that we liked about it, but there was also some stuff where we were like, I don't know if we feel like engaging with this. Or we were just also creating a lot of original stuff for it. And I think most game masters probably think about that at some point. You go like, you know, how can I get exactly what I want out of this? And you could, you know, implement the homebrew or make some tweaks to whatever system you're running to get it a little bit more in line with the fantasy that you're trying to deliver. Or you could just make your own, because spoiler alert, it's all just like math and like words on a paper.
And it's like barely even math.
Yeah.
Like,
it's little bit of math.
It's basically, rarely will it become multiplication. It's mainly just addition and subtraction.
Yeah.
Because the dice does the random number for you.
Single variable algebra equations is as much as complicated as the math gets. And another spoiler alert, little spoiler alert for you guys, it doesn't even have to be like good or balanced, especially not at first, but we'll get to that.
Yeah,
basically you're kind of already doing it. If you're a game master in any form, you're engaging with game design to a degree already. And when you get to the point where you're like, how do I get this to really deliver the fantasy that I'm trying to create for my players, there is an option. It does take some work, but it's also really fun. Make your own thing. So
let's talk about how we did it. And this isn't necessarily exactly chronological.
No.
But like, I feel like we did start with the setting, because if you listened to Brian's interview of us, we talked about the initial concept for our, you know, creative duo being video games.
Yeah.
So like, we didn't set out to make an RPG or a tabletop RPG. We set out just to make a game.
Right. And at the time we were playing a lot of video games. Mm-hmm. We still play video games, but
so I think correct me if I'm wrong here, but I believe the setting idea came first, and we were just talking a lot about the setting for this game idea that we were cooking.
I think so. That's what I remember first more than anything. We'd already talked about some ideas of video games that it would be cool if we could make, and gotten to the point where we were doing some, like, on paper design document stuff with no idea how to implement that in a game engine. And then we kind of got away from some of our first ideas and got really hot on the idea of our own post-apocalyptic, you know, science fantasy setting.
Mm-hmm.
And, well,
I mean,
we can bounce around a little bit. Do you want to talk about some influences or?
Yeah, sure. Okay. Like, we really liked, in terms of, like, post-apocalyptic fantasy sci-fi, the mesh of, like, Adventure Time, where there is, like, legit magic, but also science.
And very clear, like, D&D influences. But then, and yeah, you might take a cursory look at Adventure Time and be like, oh, it's kind of a silly, it's a silly fantasy setting. Like, oh, why is there a school bus in the background or something? And then that starts to take on a level of its own, and you see it's a lot less like a classic fantasy setting and more like the Dying Earth or something, like millions of years in the future. Everything that we know happened, and now it's different. And it's fantasy because it's so far removed from modern day, but in the future, not the past.
And it's fantasy also because not everything needs or gets an explanation.
Yeah.
But there are some, like, Princess Bubblegum is a great character that makes it very sci-fi because she's always got an explanation for everything. It's like, you know, it's science, it's not magic.
She poo-poos the idea of magic because she's like, these are scientific principles at work, and you're using them without understanding them. And that's played for laughs, but it's... It really, stuff like that really got us cooking in the, like, in the world building space, in the idea of, like, well, how would we do something like this?
Right, so we have all this fantasy and sci-fi influence. So we stole a bunch of stuff, and that's one of the things we would recommend, put it on the board.
Yeah.
When you're making your own RPG, is straight up steal stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And you can do it in a way that isn't legitimately one-for-one stealing, but also if you do that, who gives a shit?
Yeah, and a lot of... I mean...
Be a little bit careful if you're going to take it to market.
Yeah.
And release it, obviously. You know, you don't want to infringe on other people's creativity or, you know, steal their thoughts. But, like, concepts like... have extremely advanced technology, but also just legitimately magic. And then, like, you know, we explain magic as radiation.
Yeah.
So the planet got extremely irradiated by, in Afterlife, talking about in Afterlife here, the planet of Earth got extremely irradiated by a solar event, which kind of just fucked up society as we knew it. And then from there, well, basically a nuclear war, and then that added more radiation, and then came, like, the sci-fi leaps of, like, in the broken world, just, like, you know, rampant scientific advancement, no laws, no restraints, you know, so, like, you know, crazy shit, like, you know, like, Jurassic Park, right? Like, new... races and genetic splices and all that shit, and, like, you know, the development of super soldiers and, you know, weapons of, well, mass destruction, but not necessarily, you know, nukes. But
yeah, we had a few other things we were really into. You know, the Mad Max franchise, very fun. We're both playing a lot of Fallout and liked that. The storytelling of a post-apocalyptic world, I think, really just excited both of us, because you get to see through this, like, filter of destruction, what the world used to look like, and that's cool. And then like what the current people have done with it. And I don't know. There's a lot of influences we could talk about.
Yeah, Wizards, I mean, we can
Wizards
just,
is really cool. That's another
we can
like
lift
far future sci-fi that turned magic. We were really into that sort of thing. We thought post-apocalyptic fiction was really cool. So we kind of started picking and choosing the things that we liked best, stealing when we wanted to steal and making up some original stuff. And set the foundation for this original setting. And then, okay, what do we do
right,
with
so
it?
So we have this setting, right? And we're playing tabletop role-playing games. So we're thinking, hey, we have this setting, and we just slap some mechanics, some dice rolls, some stats into this setting, and boom, we got ourselves a game, right? Which is exactly what we did. So we basically started with an idea of, wouldn't this be a cool, like, alternate universe, you know, whole universe, you know, setting, and then said, okay, let's build from there. Make it playable.
Yeah.
That's not necessarily the only way to do it, of course.
No, and it's also an oversimplification of
what we did.
Of what
and
we
of
did.
Course, like, you know, we'd come up with a new idea and like, okay, well, we need to make mechanics for this, and then we make those mechanics, and we're like, okay, well, then that means this
that,
in terms
yeah,
of setting.
Yeah, that'll change stuff. And
so, like, you know, it became a kind of, oh, you change one thing, you gotta change the other. So we add a new mechanic, we gotta change the setting a little bit. We add some new, like, lore and canon and stuff. Oh, we gotta add a new mechanic. But
yeah, right. But that's, you know,
let's
so
talk
that's
about these mechanics.
We had the foundation of this world. We knew how we wanted it to look, and so there was a handful of things that we needed to support with a, you know, a rule system, mechanics that represented the ideas that were the setting and made them actually, you know, interactive when you sit down at the table to play. And for basically any setting that you're coming up with for any type of game, you kind of got to start with just like, what are the basic actions? What dice do you roll and how is it affected by what is your character? You know, those things. The basic dice roll mechanic. You got to figure that out.
Like, when do you roll a dice, right? Mm-hmm. So for us, for Afterlife, we were playing Torg at the time, as we keep mentioning, and we're never going to stop.
Probably not.
So Torg is a stat plus... Wait. Was it a stat plus skill?
Yeah, it's an attribute plus skill.
System. So what that means is you have your like base attributes, right, that describe the abilities of your character, right? Dexterity, strength, perception.
And that concept should be pretty familiar to anybody, even if you've only played D&D, because that's how D&D is essentially structured as well. But D&D has classes and species that directly affect some of that stuff. Torg did not have any of that. It had a much more in-depth skill system where tiers of skill could be increased. Bonuses from your skills could affect different attributes in different situations. And you even had the freedom to make up your own skills, because they're like, well, we're not going to put a skill in there for you to be a, you know, a master oil painter. But if your character is one...
Although that, I think that's a bad example, because I think they did have a skill called painting.
Did they? I thought that was like, I thought I was quoting the blurb about making up your own skill.
They definitely had that blurb, but I think, or maybe it wasn't specifically painting, but it was like art or something like that.
Okay, yeah. Yeah.
But if they did have, they had a non-comprehensive list of skills.
They had like the 16 or 20 or whatever main ones, and then they were like, also, you know, make them up if you need to. And we really liked that, so that's kind of how we started to thinking.
And it also used a D20, and D&D also uses a D20, and we were vaguely familiar, well, pretty familiar, but like never like intimately familiar with D&D at that point. And we actually, you know, went through several iterations of basic actions, and like, you know, we had different styles of, mm-hmm. you know, how the attributes affect the role and all this stuff. And we had conversations about, like, other systems, more kind of indie systems, like, what's that one that I always forget? It's like the D100 percentile rolls.
Zweihander?
No. But anyways, there's other, like, core systems that don't use a D20, that mm-hmm. use, like, a D100 or a D10, etc.
Yeah.
So we landed on a D20 because... Yeah. We were just more familiar with that one.
Yeah. And our first version of that was a little bit messy. We thought it was clever at first, and I think it actually was. It required constant consulting the table. So what we had was like a multiplication table where we had difficulty 1 to 20, mm-hmm. and then your attribute value 1 to 20. So you'd have your attribute and your skill bonus, and that would give you a number up to 20. And then you would cross that over to the difficulty.
Find the corresponding... Yeah.
You know, the game master is the one who sets. Like, yeah. the difficulty check for this is 16. So what is the 16 by,
right.
you know, whatever?
So we didn't...
And that would give you a dice... that would give you a difficulty to hit.
Right. And so you didn't add anything to your dice roll.
Mm-hmm.
But your skill, like, on top of your attribute, changed the number you needed to roll.
Yeah.
Right? Which is just basically, like... extra steps, like Cosmo said, kind of just you're always consulting the table, whereas if you have a base roll and then add on to that, it's basically the same math. It's just a little more
the math fluid, is identical, which is why Dane said earlier that there's not that much math, and there's not, mm-hmm. but you should have, you know, you should have like a basic high school math education at least, probably, because then you look at a system like that and you realize, hey, these are the same. Mm-hmm. Or they're getting you the same mathematical result.
Yeah.
So if we took it off of this page and just put it on the character sheet, that would be easy. That would be more easily accessible to the players.
It made the game more fluid. Yeah.
Even though the actual math of difficulty ratings versus dice rolls didn't actually change.
Right. So we were playtesting while we were developing too, which mm-hmm. is... something we can talk a little bit more in the lessons.
Yes.
But yeah, so we decided our basic actions were on a D20 dice mm-hmm. system. And then building on that, right? So like we have this cool setting and we have all these influences that we've been thinking about. And so like now we got the basic actions and, you know, let's build on that, right? So like we started talking about specific situations, for example, combat encounters.
Mm-hmm.
Like, how did we want to do combat? So, because we were just coming up with this, you know, in the backyard, and, you know, longtime listeners of the podcast will have heard us talk about accessibility and, like, you know, ease of use,
mm-hmm.
and, like, we had RPG Lite at that point, and we liked the simplicity and openness of the action economy just being like, you can do two things, and like, here's a bunch of stuff that you can do, right? Instead of a more rigid action economy like D&D of...
Yeah.
Right.
An action, a movement, a bonus action, and a reaction. All those keywords with however many different possible things that you could do as reactions or bonus actions.
And
whatever.
Like the classes and the different species all added or subtracted from your action economy, which we thought was just unnecessary.
Mm. So we settled on... fairly simple. You get to do two things every turn.
Mm-hmm.
We liked that. You could move twice, attack twice, move, attack, move, do a different action, attempt two different actions, whatever. We liked that. And then when we were thinking about combat, hit points, toughness, damage, that sort of thing, we opted to go for something completely original and created a table of like wound effects instead of damage dice reducing hit points.
And again, it went through several iterations. Mm-hmm. What we landed on is one of your essential attributes, your base attributes, is also kind of your hit points.
Yeah.
And that's the way it is now, and we've actually kind of rethought that, and, you know, no spoilers, but that might change in an updated version of Afterlife. Mm-hmm. But for now, like, your toughness stat doesn't really have any roles. Like, because, like, some games have, like, or I guess D&D, it's constitution. Mm-hmm. And...
Well, and we would use toughness the same way in Afterlife, where, like, if you were for some reason trying to hold your hand in a fire longer than somebody else, that'd be a toughness roll, probably.
But it doesn't, like, affect your hit points.
Yeah.
Right? So, your character's toughness is their hit points. Mm-hmm. And depending on how injured they are, depends on the damage. So an attack comes in, it hits you, say. Right? If this is your first attack, it's probably not going to be that bad. Or if this is your first time taking damage, I mean, it's probably not going to be that bad.
Yeah.
But the more hits you take, the worse and
the
worse it gets.
The worse each next one is going to be. And to enforce that idea of lethality, instead of reducing hit points with a damage dice, your toughness value was checked against the damage rating of the weapon coming in. Mm-hmm. And then we would roll on a random table to give you a injury or a wound or something. And it starts out very nominal. You just take a glancing blow, which is essentially losing one hit point. And it goes way worse from there, all the way up to, like, getting sucking chest wounds or getting your arm chopped off.
And I think, I can't remember on the revised table, did we bump it down or did we just bump damage up? I think around in 11, if you take like 11 points, air quotes, 11 points of damage in one attack, you might just straight up die. There's a 1 out of 10 chance of dying.
Starting at about 11. So, and that means that the difference between the damage and your toughness has to equal 11 or greater.
Mm-hmm.
It's a little bit finicky, but it actually makes a lot of sense when you look at the sheet.
It's finicky to explain without without the sheet.
But it's very simple. It's a single page of a table, and you just subtract your toughness value from the damage value. That gives you a result, and you roll to see what injury you take.
We chose that / came up with that because we wanted real, like, threats of dying, and we like the idea of every fight can be deadly. And we didn't like the idea of a slugfest that D&D sometimes gets into, where it's just like round after round, you're grinding down to nubs.
Yeah.
Like, we want it to be quick, right? You take one hit, you know, now you're on the bottom tier of the table, and, like, you know, you're getting your arm chopped off, you're bleeding, you're getting a bullet through the lung, you're on death's door.
But the same thing happens to the enemies, and they suffer the same table of effects. So in a quick combat that never lasts more than, like, 2 or 3 rounds, except against, like, the occasional big scary boss character, you know, three-ish rounds of combat. In those rounds, a couple people miss their shots, a couple people hit their shots, and suddenly, after a couple of people have been hit, the balance of that fight has shifted really heavily, really quickly.
Yeah.
And so we liked that. It also was very narrative, which we liked.
Yes. Extremely narrative. We have, like, prompts, I guess you would call them. So, like, once you assess how much damage and, like, the wound that a character suffers, we have this wounds table that tells you a little bit about the wound. And it's more of just, it's really just a prompt to say, like, what happened, right? Yeah. So, like, an amputation of a limb, right? Was it sliced off? Was it blown off by a gun? Was it just, like, turned into meat? That's up to the game master.
Yeah, and you might have to change it a little bit for like a robot character. Mm-hmm. But that idea is still there, and it gave whoever was game mastering something to consult to describe, you know, visceral and high stakes results to combat encounters, which we liked.
Right, and yeah, that's why we landed on what we landed on, is because we thought that was cool. Mm-hmm. And like basically, yeah, all the mechanics that we landed on, it's because we thought they were cool. So like that's something to put on the board when you're making up mechanics for your game.
The things that are
go
cool.
Go with what is cool.
The things that you think will be fun.
Maybe you think the action economy of D&D is really cool, then use that.
Yeah. I mean, I would say there's something to be said for it. The four different kinds of actions in D&D. If you set up a round of combat with this is what every character can do, then you can create a situation where players can do a lot of stuff. It sucks, I think, and we never really liked it, how, you know, lower level D&D characters can't really use a lot of that stuff.
Yeah.
Or how things that you feel like you should just be able to do are tied to a bonus action. You're like, oh, well, I already used my bonus action for this round, so I can't do that again, even though it's something that it seems like my character should be able to do, whatever. But, yeah, you want it. So that's kind of where we landed with combat. And then it took us a little while to balance that with the spread of attributes that were, you know, possible for a character to have. And with the ranges and damages for the weapons that were available.
Yeah.
But after a while, we kind of shook that into place. And then we kind of got into magic, which was always there,
and
but
like again, this is not
iterations.
Chronological. We didn't do this in exact. We didn't do this in order. Good order to talk about it in, right? Because our magic system is also very loose. So you don't have, there isn't like specific like combat magic and out of combat magic. Mm-hmm. It's kind of just magic.
Or a written list of spells anywhere. What we instead did, and this was after a couple of iterations, we landed on a couple different schools of magic where, you know, like, is this something that you're doing to affect another character's mind? Is this something where you're physically moving stuff or creating stuff in the world? Those kind of questions. And then we kind of... for a little while, we were a little stuck.
Yeah.
We had a couple versions of this that worked and didn't work super well. Some of them we thought, like, they worked on paper, but they weren't very conceptually accessible to players because our players hadn't written the system, so they're like, well, I'm not really sure what to do with this.
Right, and like, and, you know, some were just not as cool as we thought.
Yeah.
And that's more about playtesting, more about that later.
Yeah.
So the magic system we landed on is very open, so like no, you know, known spells or spell lists or nothing like that. If you can do magic, that will be a roll. It will be a roll whether you're in combat or not.
Mm-hmm.
And the difficulty of that roll will change vastly depending on
what you're
attempting to do with magic.
So the magic system is essentially a 2-page series of tables that list all the things that you can interact with, or that's a bad way to say.
Ways you could interact
with
magic.
Yeah, they list all the variables that are mechanically
or at least
supported.
That we thought were important.
All the mechanically supported variables, like how much damage a thing does if you're trying to do damage, how much range, how far away you're doing magic, duration, how long is the effect gonna last,
area of effects.
Yeah, stuff like that. And then we have like catch-all at the bottom where you're like, okay, this is what I want to do with my magic spell. There's a couple tiers of just like, what is the story effect? Mm. Is it kind of a trivial story effect? Like, tie someone's shoelaces together? Or
killing the big bad.
Killing the big bad by, like, you know, making him fall off a cliff.
Slurching his brain or something.
Yeah. So, if it's... And the rest of the mechanics directly tie to that in terms of difficulty. So if you're trying to do a lot of damage, your roll is going to be tougher. Mm-hmm. If you're trying to shoot a spell really far or affect something farther away with magic, the difficulty increases. And so you just go down through these tiers and add up the difficulties. So you're like, I'm going to do this much damage to this many people at this distance. Okay. That gives you a spell difficulty of like 17 mm-hmm. or whatever, and you know that 17 is the number you got to beat to cast that spell. So you're kind of making spells on the fly, which we think was really cool. We thought that was a fun way for magic users to be doing magic.
Right, because of the like world building and like setting, we should go back and talk about world building and setting with like combat and basic actions. Mm-hmm. But since we're talking about magic right now, like the way we had just talked about magic in the like setting creation, it's like being attuned to just like the vibes of the universe, right? Like the earth is flooded with extra radiation and yeah. it gets weird. And magic users are just especially attuned to those like vibes. So they can do pretty much anything.
Yeah.
It's not...
Radiation is like the force. It's just there everywhere. And if you're radiation sensitive, you're a magic user. And your use of magic is how strong of a magic user you are, which is your attributes. You know, what is your bonus in the attribute tied to the spell you're trying to cast? And then your creativity and imagination for how you use the magic.
And I was gonna slag off D&D, but, like, I've been playing Baldur's Gate 3 and learning a lot more about, like, the magic system in D&D. So what I was gonna say is something I forgot. So our system is actually a lot... It has some similarities with D&D's magic system, where, like, it's the weave, right? This, like, you know... unknown kind of indescribable force.
Yeah, that permeates everything. Right.
And the classes in D&D have interactions and, like, they interact with the weave in different ways, right? You know, you have sorcerers who are, like, naturally talented and, like, maybe it's because they have, like, dragon blood. Because
their blood is magic.
Right? They have this ancient unknown connection. And then you have, like, wizards who are, like, extremely studious. Mm-hmm. And they go through, like, trial and errors. And then you have warlocks who are, like...
I was thinking of wizards in D&D as, like, almost like a coder. Mm-hmm. Or, like, a software engineer.
Yeah, or, like...
They learn the sort of esoteric rules that bind the universe together. And because they know that, then, like, written spells and incantations are almost like a program that kind of breaks those laws.
Right, like,
or applies them in different ways.
What are they called in The Matrix? The code guys.
Yeah. Well, hackers, right?
No. Operators.
Operator. Yeah.
Right, where it's like, oh, you want to load up Kung Fu? Boom.
Yeah.
I got you. So it turns out we had our magic system that we landed on is actually more similar than I thought.
Certainly in concept.
Yeah, in concept. And I think in practice it works very differently. Mm-hmm. So, like, that's kind of, like, where we went back and forth on how do we define magic mechanically to fit our, like, setting that we have, you know, talked about and like. So, like, everybody technically has access to magic. Every character technically could do magic. But we limit it with mechanics and saying, like, okay, to actually, like, use magic to, like, further your character's goals in terms of combat and, like, you mm-hmm. know, interacting extremely.
If this is how you do adventure.
Mm-hmm.
Adventuring. By using magic.
Interacting with magic while adventuring, you have to have, like, practiced. And we didn't put any guidance on, like, how or why these specific characters actually have magic. It's just they are more in tune with radiation than a character who doesn't use magic.
Yeah. And So again, the whole point of this section is we thought of mechanics that reinforce the fiction, and we had to go through some iterations of it. But what we landed on is something that, you know, was the best version we could come up with to reflect the fantasy with the math of the dice.
Right. And not necessarily the fantasy, but our fantasy specifically, right? So, like, in combat, we wanted it to be deadly. We wanted it to be gritty and visceral. So that's why we made the combat that we made. If you are much more, you and your table are much more interested in, like, interpersonal, like, social interactions, that's probably going to be a little more robust. We don't really have robust mechanics for that in Afterlife. It's mainly just like, well, you know, oh, you want to intimidate somebody? Are you doing it with charisma? Are you doing it with your muscles? Are you, like, putting a gun to his head? It's pretty, you know, simple and kind of just loose and not well defined. We focused on the combat aspects. But, like, you know, if you're making your own game, what are you really into? Like, I could see in a different setting, not Afterlife, but like some video games do it really well, but like the attitude, the like attitude stat of NPCs and like, oh, is this person
something that shows their disposition, you know, to you? Oh, yeah. They really hated that. Or, you know, they trust you now.
That's something we didn't fuck with. Yeah. But like, if that's what you and your table are into, spend more time in that than the combat table.
Develop that more.
So, one last thing to put on the board about mechanics is when you make your own, they are changeable, right? Because you're in charge of them. Mm-hmm. So, change and tweak them when they don't fit. Or when they could be better.
Yeah.
And then you get yourself a final product, like we have.
Then, after, you know, a few years of working on it and some years of
it doesn't necessarily have to take you 3 years.
Yeah. But maybe not. I don't know. Maybe it takes longer.
Maybe it takes less.
And then this is something we talked about, whether or not we were going to talk about this or give any sort of advice about this. And we landed on, we're just going to tell you a little bit about what happened for us and then tell you, you got to figure this out for yourself. We had some art that I had just created down the line as we were working on this. I would also occasionally create some art for it. So we populated the inside of the book with that. We spent some of our own money to hire a real artist to make us a cover. And then we muddled through the layout software and getting a publishing compatible PDF. And we chose DriveThruRPG to publish and distribute on. 'Cause it, you know, there were a few other options, but the cut was, we thought, reasonable, and the visibility was reasonably high, so that's what we picked. The process that you go through when you get to that part, probably going to look very different. There's all kinds of other ways to do that. There's lots of other platforms out there. There's also, like, crowdfunding and stuff. We did none of that. We just put this all together in-house and spent a little bit of our own money. But,
So if you're taking it to market, I think whatever works best for you and your price / like how much am I gonna do versus like what's worth paying somebody to do, that's a decision you're gonna have to, you know, that you can make. We can't make that for you. We kind of did it half and half, right? Like, we bought some stuff to help us, and then is it perfect? No, but we think it works.
Yeah. And we're happy with it. And the main reason I think we're happy with it is, like, it is a physical thing that represents, you know, some years of work and a lot of hours of thinking about thinking about this idea and being like, well, yeah, we should write it down. It was a good thing we said that in the beginning. But I think really the payoff and the thing that is, you know, most to be proud of is that we play this still and consistently with our player group. But instead of just, like, stapled together printouts, we're able to now
have official-looking books.
This is a real color-printed book, and an actual book, not a printout, not a, you know, not a staple-bound or three-ring binder thing. This is a book from a printer, and that's cool. And still the same game we're playing, but...
And it's something to be proud of.
Yeah.
I think. I'm proud of it.
And the, you know, the reward for me very much was still kind of the journey, but seeing the final thing is undeniably cool. Mm-hmm. Then you get the final thing and you're like, well, obviously we're not done.
Yeah.
We're
going to keep doing
stuff. So it's not like you get to just stop.
Well, it's not like you have to stop.
Yeah. When you get the final thing, but getting the final thing is fucking cool. So, reiterating kind of the first thing, we kind of think this is something you should try. If you're doing any sort of game design or thinking about game design, maybe just do your own. Maybe just make your own. It's pretty fucking cool. But on that note, let's move on to
lessons.
Some of the lessons we learned from this.
How it made us better.
Yeah.
Right? That's what we're going to talk about now. So the biggest thing was we got a much better understanding of why the mechanics are the way they are in any system,
mm-hmm.
right? Because you start to learn, when you create your own mechanics, you start to learn, it's like, okay, this is what I'm trying to simulate here, and like, this is why it's important. How is that best reflected in the mechanic, right? Mm-hmm. Kind of like, what is load-bearing versus what can be removed if you don't like it?
Yeah. I think a terrific example of that to, you know, just because it's fun to slag off D&D a little bit, is like weights and encumbrances. Honestly, like, you start to do a little bit of this on your own, and then you look at something like that in the player's handbook and the DM's guide for Dungeons and Dragons, and you're like, this is an entire concept that could be thrown away and it would only make the game better. And many parties and game masters don't even bother with it because it is tedious. And what do you get out of engaging with that tedious mechanic is you get you get hamstrung sometimes. You're like, oh, but hang on. Sorry, something has to be worse because this is heavy.
Yeah, and it usually comes at like a... bad way to start that sentence.
Okay.
What I meant to say was it usually not only is just like, oh, shit, I can't carry this right now. It's like two sessions later and it's like, oh, yeah. Fuck.
This I wasn't whole able time, to,
you
yeah.
know, all that stuff that we did, I actually, you know, didn't actually have the, you know, capacity to carry, yeah. you know, all that,
like,
you know.
Oh, fuck, now suddenly stuff. I'm heavy. Now I'm over, that's...
It's like, do we go back and retcon, you know, the shit that
right.
was fucked up by this?
Re-narrate like, some of that shit, or...
You know, it's like, oh, that was like 3 sessions ago, which could be 6 months
yeah,
of real
know.
Time. So
certainly hours of gameplay.
Yeah.
And it's not just that. It's not just, you know, encumbrance in D&D. You start to just kind of, like, the way the operators in the Matrix look at that screen of scrolling green symbols, and somehow they are seeing the real world the way it is, you start to, you know... You start to just look at RPGs that way a little bit. You start to see the true nature of things. You see the math and the, like, you know, the language rules that are holding it together. And you start to learn why things are the way that they are, what their purpose is, and what is, yeah, to what you said, load-bearing.
Right.
and what is superfluous.
To quote Morpheus, some rules can be bent, some can be broken. Mm-hmm. So making your own RPG, or not necessarily going the whole fucking distance like we did and bringing something to market, but just tweaking rules mm-hmm. and kind of coming up with your own homebrew mechanics really gets you a feel for, like, okay, this, I see what this is trying to do, but, like, for my players, that's just going to be annoying.
Yeah.
Like, they're going to hyper-focus on this and yeah. take away from the actual gameplay.
So then look at that and be like, well, yeah, I can see that this is going to annoy them or they're not going to want to engage with it, so look on the next page and see what does it actually change or affect. Mm. Decide if you need it or not, and then lose it. Also, another aside, this is kind of... this is an interjecting point, not really in the bullet points here, but you just mentioned you don't necessarily have to take a thing to market. Mm. I want to reiterate that for anyone listening. We did, you know, complete a publishable, like, final manuscript of our game, put some art in it, and put a cover on it, and then publish it to DriveThruRPG. But the main thing we do with it is still just play it with our players. So that can be it. You don't need to go any further than that. You can write a original game just for your players and your party, your home table. Mm. And that is still... all of this good still applies.
Yeah.
You don't need to be... you don't need to have something to sell at the end of it, necessarily.
And you don't need to make it understandable for everybody.
Yeah.
You only need to make it understandable.
That's a good one. That's not in this lesson bullet point, really, mm-hmm. but...
And it's to the point of this next bullet point.
Yeah.
I know the listeners are like, what the fuck are you talking about? Mm.
We have a piece of paper we look at.
When you make it up, you know exactly what you fucking mean by it.
Mm-hmm.
So when, and your players don't necessarily, so you have to at least explain it well enough
mm-hmm.
that your players can grasp a little bit of it.
But with you there to tell them, they will get it.
That is just, even though we made all this up and most of it, like, was in our head when we were first playtesting, we explained it to our players at least well enough that it wasn't such a time drag to, like, explain it. Because, like, you know, your players, for example, D&D, you get this fucking player handbook that's, like, 150 pages. They're still going to have some questions, especially, you know, if they're just starting out. They're going to be like, wait a second, okay, a save roll? I don't know how to do that.
Yeah, where do I get that
on my character sheet? Tell me how to do that,
mm-hmm.
right? So I think making it is an extreme advantage for the game master, because they don't have to go look it up and, like, oh shit, you're asking about some obscure rule in the player handbook that I don't know page for page. Well, like, give me the handbook and our flip through. You don't need to do that when you've made it up. When you've made it up, you're just like, oh yeah, here's how it goes. Because your players will still ask those questions regardless of, you know, if this is something you bought off the shelf or something you made up.
Yeah.
So, like, you're just able to be so much quicker with it and, like, actually make good rulings without that referencing time.
And we'll, jumping off, adding another wrinkle to that, I would say that so how long do you think it took us to make Afterlife start to finish?
I mean, to the final project, or to the playable product?
Final.
Final product? I believe it was 5 years.
5 years. I would say a year and a half of that, there was no game. We were just talking about the world.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, a good 4 years of just homebrew game development. I would say probably a full year of that time was spent trying to revise and optimize the language of our game system so that it could be distributed to anybody, to mm-hmm. people who, you know, people who have it in our immediate wouldn't
table.
Be in the room right. with us to have us clarify our intention. So we had to look at this and be like, okay, so how do we write this so that anybody
right.
would pick in it up and clear, arrive at the concise, same conclusion yeah. and treat it the same way we're treating
exactly.
it. And that can be fucking agonizing. So maybe you just don't want to bother going that far. Maybe you don't want to take your thing all the way to being a product to publishing. Mm. And because if you aren't worried about that, you can just write almost yeah. in shorthand for you and your players and create something really great that works for you guys.
Really quickly.
And not waste time revising the language of the core document so that anybody who reads it the same. Mm-hmm. You know, and they're still not going to be able to. You're still never going to be able to achieve that perfectly. There's always going to be points of misunderstanding and confusion. Mm-hmm. So that's a lesson that I just thought of.
On the player side, it also makes you a better player. Even if you're not, so the same thing holds that, like, you know, if you made this up with your buddies and then you play as it, right, you're going to have a lot deeper understanding and, like, you know, you can understand that shorthand. But also, if you're playing a different system you bought off the shelf, but you've made your own RPG before, or maybe not, you know, the whole pig, but, like, you've tweaked some stuff and you've started to, like, you know, game design yourself, it still helps you as a player in, like, a, you know, a system off the shelf. Because you get to read those, you know, lines of code, back to the Matrix operator mm-hmm. analogy. You get to see, like, oh, okay. So, like, as a player, I want to do this. I understand how it works in this system. I don't need to ask the game master, you know, oh, can I do this? No, it's like, I'm going to do this. Game master, here's how I do this. I use my, you know, equipment, I use my grappling hook gun mm-hmm. to wrap somebody up or something. And, you know, you just get a lot more creative, and confidence, I guess, is also another word.
Yeah.
That's good to mention here. Because you've been there. You know what the other side looks like. You know the intentions behind these rules.
Mm-hmm.
So you can bend them a little bit.
Yeah. And you can do what I think is the, you know, it makes you better at doing what I consider the better version of playing, which is, you know, you describe what you're going to do.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, sort out what attributes or what actions or what dice rolls are required once the intent is established.
Yeah. And it's out of the box. It's not just like, oh, okay, well, I attack.
Mm-hmm.
But it's like, okay, well, I'm going to attack in this way.
Yeah. I flourish my sword at him and I go for a this, as opposed to, like, I make strength check to attack
yeah.
with my sword. It's going to get you more towards one and further away from the other if you actually spend a little bit of time in the game development space.
Mm-hmm.
You'll kind of inversely, you'll start talking, you'll start describing your play more narratively, because the mechanical stuff is going to kind of be
second nature.
Yeah, it's going to become more second nature. Mm-hmm. That's going to run on autopilot, and you're going to describe the story that you're wanting.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Another big thing is learning what you like and don't like, right? Like, oh, we got this system with all these rules. Well, you know what? I didn't include in my own system was, you know, this stupid thing. So, hey, Game Master, can we not use this rule of this new system? Because, mm-hmm. like, here's why I think it's bad. Here's why I think it will slow the game down or something like that.
Yeah.
You can start to express those thoughts and advocate for what you really want.
Mm-hmm. And you learn, you know, I learned that even though I think our like wound tables and death spiral mechanics for Afterlife is very cool, in things I've worked on previous or since then, I've kind of gone back to a more simple like hit dice or damage dice versus hit points thing. And I've been experimenting with that. Still, I still miss the the deeper narrative that comes from a table of more specific combat effects. But I also learned that, like, it seems like players really like rolling more dice about stuff. So there's, you know, there's an element of that. Like, maybe I like this better.
Mm.
You have to do some of that iteration and practice, and then you will start to learn that, and then you will zero in. You'll zero in more and more on the type of game you want to run and the type of player you want to be when you're on the player side of things.
Perfect segue into playtesting.
Mm-hmm.
And helpful feedback. So, one of the lessons, one of the big lessons we learned is about that. So, like, playtesting, it takes time.
Yeah.
You're probably not going to nail it exactly on the first try. It's going to take some dialing in. It's going to take some practice, if you will, which is A-okay and natural. At least, you know, for us.
Mm-hmm.
So, we want to talk a little bit about how you can get the most out of your playtesting.
Yeah. So, at first, you're going to bring this to your players, and you need something from them. You need feedback that you might not know how to ask for. And they'll be like, oh, that was fun, or like, oh, that seemed kind of broken,
right,
or whatever. But like
asking, hey, how'd the session go? I enjoyed it.
Not helpful. And appreciate it. Glad you came. Glad you played. Thank you for playing. I hope everyone had fun. Oh, yeah, cool. You got to ask some more specific questions. In the earliest build of Afterlife, melee combat was super underpowered. And we had to do some stuff to fix that, and we kind of had to ask why. And we did get a little bit of feedback from players being like, oh, well, it seems like if I got a sword, I can't really do anything, because some players and some enemies have guns.
Hmm.
And they didn't tell us exactly how that needed to be changed.
Right. And so, but, you know, saying that, you kind of can read between the... or hearing that, you can kind of read between the lines. It's like, okay, it seems like I can't really do anything. Okay, so, like, maybe movement is the problem.
Yeah.
Right? Maybe you just can't get to a guy before your you know, co-adventurers shoot him. You're like, okay, so maybe, you know, we increase movement for melee. Maybe there's a special movement for melee or something like that.
And we did. We added some stuff like that. We also adjusted the damage tables so that melee did more damage. Kind of more damage than it would reasonably do compared to a gun. But just mechanically, there's greater payoff for the risk that you take to get into melee combat.
I think that goes back to our setting. Is I think that makes a decent amount of sense, because this is a post-apocalyptic, in Afterlife, talking specifically Afterlife here.
Mm-hmm.
Post-apocalyptic, you know, the world's been through a lot of shit. Like, finding the type of ammo that you would find now is just like a rare, valuable, really legendary thing.
And it's probably not from, like, a factory with you know, most smokeless gunpowder. It's probably, like cheap black powder reloads.
And, like, you know, that... Or like, I like to imagine that the judge in Blood Meridian, when he makes gunpowder, he's like, yeah, I'm just going to throw, you know, all this dirt and, you know, sulfur in here. All right, everybody piss
in
it.
Now everyone pissing it. I'm going to turn it into gunpowder.
Like, that's what people are rocking in guns.
Yeah.
And so, like, yeah, you know, makes sense that...
So, yeah, maybe the bullets don't hit as hard, but a nice sword or a, you know, a nice sharp axe...
That shit hasn't changed since the Paleolithic, or whatever.
Whenever they invented swords.
So, specific questions, but also the feedback that you get... you know, learning to read in between the lines and kind of, you know,
say like, oh, this gun sucks, or like, this mechanic, well, that didn't do anything for me, that's useless, or I wasn't able to do anything. Well, you gotta kind of pop the hood on that and be like, well, if that is true, why, and what are the mechanical variables that I can adjust that will you know, more favorably tweak that.
And that one was kind of easy. It came naturally for us, you know, Tap the Sign, Remsel. if you listen to
Take a Drink.
Yeah. Episode 100, you kind of got some ears full of that, but so like debriefing with purpose, like, you know, talking about the session, asking specific questions, and really pushing your players to explain what they think could be better about mechanics and like what is working really well about mm-hmm. mechanics, that will help you tweak that stuff and, you know, make your homebrew better. And on that, it can be, you know, a little damaging to your ego, and it's like, oh, well, this actually sucked ass, and like, here's why. And
you can, like, you risk a bit of a like a mental radiation burn the more you agonize about this stuff, because mm-hmm. it can turn into self-critical, self-deprecating, in like negative criticism, not productive critique. So, you know, we talked about this in episode 96. We have been doing this for a long time. We've been thinking about it for a long time. And sometimes it gets on top of us a little bit and we forget why we do this, which is to have fun with fun mm-hmm. stuff and to play pretend in a fun way. And you get a little too in your head thinking, you know, what worked? Why didn't this work? Does any of it work? Oh God, I suck. So be careful of that. It asks, this process is going to ask you to critique and examine yourself and your experiences a lot. And if you do that too much without keeping things in perspective, it can become a little unhealthy.
Mm-hmm. Mic drop, motherfucker.
Mic drop. So, to recap, we kind of think everyone should take a whack at making their own RPG. We talked about the process that we went through making Afterlife, why mm-hmm. we wanted to do that, what fun we were having, and how that became, you know, in-depth world building that then had to be supported by a game system.
We also talked about if you're daunted by it, don't be, because you're probably
already doing it a little bit. Tweaking
stuff, right? Anything homebrew, you've already dipped your toe in the pool.
Yeah. We talked about the changes, the tweaks that came from that, this balance of the fiction and the mechanics. How do the mechanics support the fiction? If we implement this mechanic, does it change the fiction a little bit? That sort of thing. And then we talked about how cool it is to have a final product. And we also qualified that your final product does not need to be a published thing
market,
on a shelf.
Right. It doesn't need to be in market.
It can just be a nice document that you and your friends use to play the game that you guys want to play.
Mm-hmm.
Then we talked about some lessons. The understanding of mechanics, the greater comprehension of just how this stuff works that comes from the practice of game design. Improving game mastering and player skills. Learning what you do and don't like and focusing on the good. And the process of playtesting, feedback, and self-reflection that is necessary if you want to dive into something like this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Very good. So, I mean, that's going to do it for this episode of Two-Headed Game Master. Be sure to hit us up on our websites, 2hgm.com.
Mm-hmm. You can email us. There's a link to our Patreon. Patrons get access to our exclusive Discord. They get to participate in fun things like the Halloween Spooktacular we do every year. That's coming up soon.
That is coming up.
First
thing you're going to see, though, is what we basically spent the whole episode talking about is our original setting and rule system called Afterlife, a post-apocalyptic fantasy role-playing game.
Yep.
Available now at DriveThruRPG for
a nominal fee.
Nominal fee. You can get a PDF or a print version. If you buy the print version, a little more expensive, but we got to cover printing costs.
Mm.
If you buy the print version, you get the PDF for free, so you can have a Game Master copy of the books and then send the PDF to your players for player character creation.
Yep.
Please, if you do end up buying it, please share with your friends or anybody who else is interested, because we think it's cool, and... Mm-hmm.
And we think you might, too.
Yeah.
Thank you to the Burning Saviors for the use of the song Pond Hill is Finest as the intro and outro to our show. And we'll see y'all on the next one.
See you next time.